Now, summer is a great time to get outside, but it's also a great time to go inside, maybe into a movie theater. Some of the biggest blockbuster hits were released in the summer. For example, here's one that was released on June 11th, 1993.
How fast are they?
Well, we clocked the T-Rex at 32 miles an hour.
T-Rex?
Mm-hmm.
You said you've got a T-Rex?
Uh-huh.
Say again.
We have a T-Rex.
Wow.
Put your hand between your knees.
Dr. Grant, my dear Dr. Sattler, welcome to Jurassic Park.
That is a clip from the classic Jurassic Park, directed by Steven Spielberg. I actually remember seeing that in the theater as a kid, and it's just one example of a great summer movie. And we want to hear about your favorite summer classics, or maybe a blockbuster. It could be Star Wars, or maybe it's a sleeper hit that no one has heard of. So call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jocelyn Zapaniak Galise is an associate professor of English and Film Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She wrote the book The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship, and Modernized American Theater Architecture. Jocelyn, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me. I always love being on Central Time.
And we always love having you on. Okay, so we are in the middle of summer right now. You know, what really sets apart a summer classic from something that might come out in, you know, late autumn or early winter?
Sure. We can think about a kind of seasonality of movies. And when we think about summer movies, I think at this point, we really think about the blockbuster. In the winter, we go see things that are maybe a bit of Oscar bait, an art house film, something like that. But in the summer, we want to see the big stuff. And so that's really what we think about now in terms of summer films. It is the blockbuster.
So winter, you might see that French noir film, but in maybe the summer, you want to see Transformers. There's a big difference in the seasonality there. You know, how do production companies then plan these new releases in the summer?
Sure. There's kind of a long history about why we might see these giant movies in the summertime. And I want to take a step back just for a moment and talk about the history of what a blockbuster really is and why Hollywood might want to put these films on their slate for the summertime. The blockbuster, it's kind of not just a genre or a movie, but it's kind of cool to think about it as a set of ideas. And those ideas kind of surround spectacle, culture, and economics, and maybe even how we think about the nation, about America in general. So they're really about a visual spectacle that kind of distracts us from the troubles around us and makes us sort of like willing accomplices to the profit machine, which is a bit of a cynical view of the spectacle of the blockbuster, but they can also be a heck of a lot of fun. And they've really been around for quite a long time. We typically point to Jaws in 1975 and then Star Wars and Close Encounters in 1977 as this sort of starting point for the summer blockbuster, which is certainly when summer becomes the time for them. But the idea has a much longer history. As far back as the 30s, the term blockbuster was in use. Sometimes the industry would refer to them as colossals or super colossals, but blockbuster is in use as early as the 1930s. Industry and deciders are using it in the 1940s for all sorts of upcoming movies, comedies, musicals, anything that might draw audiences in. And then Variety starts using the term in 1951 with the biblical epic Quo Vadis, which is not something we might think of as a summer blockbuster today, but it was in 1951.
We are talking to Jocelyn Zapaniak Galise right now, associate professor of English and Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. And we're talking about the history of the blockbuster and, of course, getting some of your favorite summer films. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but it also feels like the blockbuster has sort of a militaristic origin. Am I correct there?
You are absolutely right. One of my favorite things to teach about when I teach particularly American film history is all of these fascinating secret connections to the military-industrial complex and our favorite form of entertainment, big overblown movies. And these connections come out in the most fascinating ways. As much as the term blockbuster gets used by the industry and then by film critics, by industry publications, and eventually by audiences, the term originally comes from the military, and it was used quite a bit in World War II to refer to nothing else than large-scale bombing campaigns. I mean, this sounds like absolutely bonkers, but when you think about the associations, it kind of makes sense, right? A blockbuster is something that awes us into submission. It's big, it's bright, it's flashing, it's full of lights. So we've got this term that migrates from the military over to the massive overblown entertainment industry. And then really fascinatingly, this is a point that I think is so interesting here. Summer blockbusters then use technology that comes from the military to make their massive special effects. So as an example, Star Wars, which had this really all sorts of really incredible special effects, but the one that it's really most famous for is the swift movement of spaceships through the galaxy. Right before Star Wars, it just kind of looked like ships were sort of hanging like puppets in the air. Star Wars, right? They look, it's like Star Trek. The Enterprise, you know, it's not really doing much. But in Star Wars, the ships are zooming all around. That technology comes originally from an anti-aircraft gun analog camera that the experimental filmmaker John Whitney retrofitted in the 1960s. And then that technology was used by John Dykstra to create Dykstraflex, which is that fabulous effect that we see in Star Wars.
And I want to just deviate for a second. We've seen other technology like that in other films. Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't Barry Lyndon utilize some sort of NASA camera to get the candlelight going? Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. And that's because it's so hard to do what Kubrick wanted to do with that film. What he was trying to do was use entirely available light. So that would have been daylight, sunlight, but then also candlelight at night. And it's very, very difficult to expose your film with just that kind of light. So you get this kind of ultra sensitive camera used there.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we continue our talk with Jocelyn Zapaniak-Galise, an associate professor of English and film studies at UW-Milwaukee. We're talking about classic summer movies. And of course, we just heard The Imperial March from Star Wars. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Call in with your favorite summer movies. Maybe it's Star Wars. Maybe it's Independence Day. So sticking with the Star Wars theme really quickly, you were talking about that and how the military industrial complex and technology that came out of that era really helped catapult a movie like Star Wars into I guess like the public imagination. Can we talk just a minute about Star Wars?
Sure, absolutely. It's such a fascinating object, mostly because, and this I think is true for so many blockbusters that we're familiar with today, right, from the 1970s on. It's so successful and fascinating and functions as such a great piece of summer escapist blockbuster entertainment in many ways because of the incredible technologies that were used in it. And they're technologies that just nobody had ever seen before. I mentioned Dykstraflex, which is this incredible, it's a very complicated motion control system that enabled the special effects technicians at Industrial Light and Magic to make it look like these ships were zooming through the sky. That's actually early microchip control, right? So as early as 1977, we see the use of microchips to make these really, really minuscule movements with the camera and therefore be able to create this tremendous illusion of like intergalactic space fighting in a way that just wasn't possible before. And this, I think, really does point to something else about the blockbuster, which is that it's not just about the story. It's not just about the quality. It's about two other things. One is a sense of kind of universality, right? Because blockbusters, they have to make money outside the borders of the United States. They have to be successful in box offices around the world in order to make the return on investment possible. But they're also about this massive sense of escape as well. And that's kind of a fascinating thing about the movies in general, right? Even these movies that seem like just major popular entertainment, maybe there's not much we can say by way of, you know, their deaths to cinephilia or things like that. But even these kind of massive, overblown popular movies tell us about all these cultural, social, and historical contexts that surround them, and thus how the movies teach us about our own histories and sociocultural contexts.
So I want to stick with the space theme, but I want to move it a little bit closer to home. One movie you wanted to talk about that fits into all of these terms is Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which came out in 1977. So let's take a quick listen to a clip from that.
Avez-vous des maux de tête, des migraines?
Having headaches, migraines.
Yeah. Irritation des yeux et du sinus.
An irritation in your eyes and your sinuses.
Yeah. Des démangeaisons, des allergies.
You have hives. You have allergies.
Des brûlures sur le visage et sur le corps.
You're burning on your face and on your body.
Yes. Who are you people?
Look at this.
Yeah, I got one just like in my living room. Who are you people?
Je pensais...
Oui, je connais. Oui, je connais. Monsieur Neri, please, one more question. N'avez-vous pas fait récemment une rencontre?
Have you recently had a close encounter?
Une rencontre plutôt inhabituelle.
A close encounter with something very unusual.
Who are you people?
So, Jocelyn, can you tell us a little bit more about Close Encounters of the Third Kind and what makes this movie a blockbuster?
Absolutely. It's so interesting. Close Encounters comes out the same year as Star Wars and also uses the same kind of motion control technology. So both Star Wars and Close Encounters use this technology from the military-industrial complex. And both of them are also kind of about military action in very, very different ways. So the technology is kind of reiterated throughout the narrative of the film itself. But Close Encounters, wow, the special effects in Close Encounters are some of my favorite effects I've ever seen. They're done by Douglas Trumbull, who makes these beautiful plays of light and movement that are just absolutely sublime on screen. Another thing that I think makes Close Encounters such a perfect blockbuster, besides the fact that it's directed by Spielberg, who is, of course, the king of the summer blockbuster, right, is that, especially as we just heard in that clip, that's François Truffaut talking, right? That's one of the people talking, who is one of the major directors of French New Wave cinema in the 1960s. And we get this moment of translation. The entire film is actually about translation and how one can communicate through means other than one's native language. We have Truffaut speaking in French, being translated into English, but we also have connection with the aliens via the use of music. So when we think about the film in that way, we can think about it as a utopian kind of space drama where we encounter some kind of mystic revelation with aliens, but we can also think about it as communicating with people from around the world in ways that are not delimited by our specific language. And that's kind of also what a blockbuster does, too.
We're talking to Jocelyn Sapaniak-Galise right now. She is an associate professor of English and film studies at UW-Milwaukee. And we are talking about summer classic movies, but also blockbusters. And I want to go back to one of your favorites that I would not have thought of it as a summer blockbuster. And it's kind of genre bending. It's the 1988 live action and animation comedy film, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Let's take a quick listen to a clip from that film.
You wouldn't have any idea where the rabbit might be, Mr. Valiant.
Have you tried Walla Walla? Cucamonga? I hear Kokomo's very nice this time of the year.
I'm surprised you're not more cooperative, Mr. Valiant. A human has been murdered by a tomb. Don't you appreciate the magnitude of that?
And that was a scene where Judge Doom is talking with Private Eye Eddie Valiant. It's a favorite of yours. What sticks out to you about this film in particular?
I mean, besides the fact that Christopher Lloyd plays a secret villain in the cartoon, what more do you need? Well, and it's partially because I really love the history of animation. It's one of the courses that I teach at UWM. And this film is so interesting. First of all, it's totally freaking weird. It is totally weird. It is live action actors like Bob Hoskins, and then all the famous animated characters that you can think about from the 20th century. Mickey Mouse, Daffy Duck, Felix the Cat, Betty Boop. Now, what's really interesting about all those characters I just named is that they're all owned by different studios. So all of these characters were created and owned by viciously competing animation studios, right? Studios that were really fighting against one another in the 1920s through really the 1950s. And this is this fascinating moment where the Walt Disney Corporation buys the rights to this novel, which, by the way, is extremely risque. It's a strange object for Disney to be interested in. They buy the rights to the novel, and they somehow convince all of these studios to allow their characters to be in the film. And this had never happened before. Like, Mickey Mouse and Daffy Duck together, that was unheard of. They were able to do it because they thought the movie was going to make a bunch of money. At the time, it was the most expensive animated film ever made, but it did pay off. The gamble paid off, and it did make a lot of money. I just love it for being so utterly weird.
Yeah, it is a very weird movie. I watched it a lot as a kid. I probably should not have. But I, when we started talking about it, I was like, oh yeah, that movie was very strange. But let's shift a little to the actual movie watching experience. Your book is called The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship and Modernized American Theater Architecture. And one thing that I think about with movies and the summer is getting to just bask in air conditioning. It's one of the reasons I like going to the movies more in the summer than maybe in the winter. How much of a draw was air conditioning for theatergoers?
Absolutely enormous. I mean, so substantial. So substantial, in fact, that people just really didn't go to the movies in the summertime until air conditioning was available. Because think about it, you're sitting in this giant room with a bunch of people sweating, right? That's kind of the last thing you want to do, right? That's pretty nasty. But in the early 1920s, some massive urban movie palaces start experimenting with certain kinds of cooling systems, but they're so enormous that they require a really significant architectural footprint. It's not really possible for smaller rural or neighborhood theaters to install them. And then Willis Carrier, who is, of course, the inventor of the air conditioning system as we know it now, comes out with a product for the movie theater in the mid-1920s. Big movie palaces end up taking that on. And then in the 1930s, a smaller system is debuted. And all sorts of theaters of any kind of size could afford and install this particular system. That's really when we see audiences going to the movies in the summer. Because before that, it was just absolute misery. And that's another thing that tells us, I think, you know, this point that I really love to make, the movies are not just about the movies. They're about all the experiences around the movies. They're about enjoying this escape into another world that's both the text of the film, but also the theater itself. This fantasy of being cool, right, in the midst of the hot and dreadful summer. That, to me, is what makes the movies such a fascinating subject to study.
Well, also, you can eat so much popcorn in a sitting in a movie theater that you might not be compelled to at home. So, Jocelyn, we've been talking about the history of the blockbuster, but I kind of want to pick your brain. I want you to pull out a crystal ball. And how do you think the blockbuster is going to, you know, evolve maybe over the next 10 or 20 years? Are we going to have Fast and Furious 1000? Or could we start seeing some new different movies coming out?
Yeah, I'm hopeful that we do see some new and different ones come out. One of the dangers that we face when making these kinds of speculations is having, you know, having a bit of tunnel vision and thinking it's only about what American audiences want, right? Because as I mentioned before, blockbusters have to not just make money here. They have to make money across the world. So I think in order to predict what we might see, we need to think about what might translate to international audiences. And I think that really is about a balance between what is familiar and what is exciting and new. So I think we will continue to see some kind of like reboots, continuations of franchises. But I also think that so much of it will be driven by what kinds of fabulous new effects technologies are possible. That's the kind of stuff that gets people into the theater. That's the kind of stuff that provides the big bombastic escape that we're used to in the summertime.
Jocelyn, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a lot of fun.
Oh, I love talking with you. Thank you so much.
Jocelyn Sapaniak-Galise is an associate professor of English and Film Studies at the University of Milwaukee, of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She wrote the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship, and Modernized American Theater Architecture. And we talked about the history of the summer blockbuster and, of course, summer classic movies.